this is Tracy.
And this is Steven.
And this is the Just the Two of Us podcast. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We had a little break there. Sorry to keep you waiting. But we are back with another podcast for you. And today we're going to be talking about the SAE, the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity incident that happened at, is this University of Oklahoma? University of Oklahoma. I get so confused because it's OU. But then I want to say Oklahoma University. It's so fast backwards to me. But anyway, that's what we're going to be talking about this show for the entire show. So let's go ahead and get started. Unless you've been under a rock, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the situation that happened at OU with the fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE. A video came out that showed some of the members on a bus going to or coming from an event, and they were chanting a very racist chant. And yes, thus causing quite an uproar amongst, well, everyone.
Everyone except for racists.
They're
probably standing and applauding. That's the racist, like.
So let's just get right into some of the points that we want to talk about regarding this crazy incident.
Well, let's talk about, let's start from the beginning. Like this, okay, when this first came out, it was pretty quick. It was a video of the students on the bus singing a song, which put a Miley talked about how proud of their heritage they were and how they would never have someone of African descent within their particular fraternity. What was your thought when you like first saw the video? What did you think?
I didn't see the video. I mean, I didn't watch the video. I've only seen clips of the video from news outlets, and I've heard, you know, I've heard it, but I haven't really watched it.
So you never even saw the video?
I never even saw it because, to be frank, I mean, I don't care about these things because maybe because I'm familiar with the Greek system. For those of you that don't know, I am a part of an organization that I have been a part of for, like 15 years. I'm part of a multicultural sorority that I began at the University of Michigan, my alma mater. And I guess I'm familiar with this type of behavior from fraternities. I also worked in Greek life during my master's program. I worked at George Washington University as well as American University with their Greek programs. And so I guess just overall, having worked in higher ed for over 10 years, I know how this, I've seen this before, and so I know how, you know, this comes across as very like outrageous to people, but this is not outrageous to me at all. So I didn't really care to see the video because frankly, I just said, oh, okay, more racist behavior from
a Greek group. Yeah. I mean, like I did watch the video and I guess just like you, I wasn't surprised but for very different reasons. I didn't pledge. I wasn't into the Greek life. But I just wasn't surprised because it's like, at this point, nothing really surprises me. You know, it's like, it's kind of like unexpected but expected. I guess unexpected in the sense that I was thinking, wow, you people are really stupid enough to videotape this.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But expected in the sense that, like, yeah, when they're alone and in sane company, a homogenous company, not mixed company, I think they would go around and sing silly chants. One thing that was very interesting about it was this news or this video, I guess whoever videotaped it sent it to the black one of the black organizations that was on campus and then at Oklahoma University, and it kind of spread like wildfire, and the video went viral in a matter of like less than a day, which was like amazing to me that it went viral so quickly.
Right.
But even more amazing was the swift action by Oklahoma University and their president and the national body for this particular fraternity. Like, mm-hmm. it was like Sunday, the video came out. Monday, Oklahoma University's president condemned it. Tuesday, they had kicked the kids out that they could identify on the video, two of the students, and told the frat brothers that they had until midnight to get up out the house, and they were kicked off campus. I'm like, this happened in a matter of like 36 hours, which is pretty amazing to me, like how
and quickly they were. Yeah. It's impressive that the university reacted so fast, and I mean, I applaud the president of OU for doing what they did and getting the situation handled so quickly.
Yeah, it was very impressive. And obviously he feels as though, because Oakland University is a public university, and obviously they felt though legally they were on solid ground with respect to kicking these students out. Because, mm-hmm. you know, typically, as you know, a public university is an agency of the state.
Uh-huh.
And with respect to that, there's certain constitutional limitations on what they can do, and one of which is like, you know, violating the freedom of speech. And you know, one could argue that, hey, these kids, it appears that they weren't on campus and they were exercising their free speech,
mm-hmm.
and what's the school going to do, you know, kicking them out and, you know, infringing on their free speech. But I guess the university felt confident enough that they were on good legal standing because they reviewed the student code of conduct and cited that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they probably went with the old argument of, you know, you have free speech, but there's free speech with limitations. It's the time, place, and manner test that applies to free speech. It's like, yeah, I have the free speech to say, you know, I can yell fire, but I can't yell fire in a crowded theater because it presents, it could cause, you know, a dangerous situation. So I think maybe the school probably relied upon that principle to say, hey, you know, by them, you know, doing these chants, they created a hostile environment that could potentially be dangerous, and,
mm-hmm.
and with respect to their particular student code of conduct could, you know, affect the ability of, you know, the learning environment as a whole, and they use that as grounds to kick them off. So, even though that's probably what they relied on, I wouldn't be surprised to see the kids and their parents lawyer up and try to sue the university for kicking them out.
Right, because I mean, it comes down to, like, you know, was it the right thing to do in this case? You know, these kids, you know, you want to bring up freedom of speech, you know, they have the right to chant whatever they want, pretty much, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, this type of behavior is not, what's the word? I'm not surprised by it. And they just so happened to get caught on tape.
Right, yeah. I mean,
so there are probably plenty of other chapters of this organization. And we'll talk about that a little bit in a little bit. How several of these chapters across the country have been involved in various incidents regarding race. But yeah, I mean, I without a doubt think that these kids would be in their fraternity house, chanting such things. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I'm sure that it happened. So this time they just got caught. So,
right, and that's the problem. It's like, you know, one thing that I thought about when the president decided to act swiftly, kick the frat off of campus, and suspend those particular students, I was just thinking, like, what does this do? Like, because you know the problem is they got caught. And it was like, okay, you kicked them off campus, mm-hmm. you punished a couple of the guys that you were able to identify, then what? Like, how does it stop this from happening in the future? Because pretty much, you know, I think in a situation where they just say, oh, crap, we just make sure we won't videotape it next time. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. this doesn't... Something like this doesn't really change hearts and minds as much as you would like. Like, yes, it offers us, mm-hmm. you know, the public who are concerned about such things, it offers us some sense of I don't know, just like, you know, some sense of satisfaction. It's like, oh, somebody was punished before that for mm-hmm. this. But it's like, I don't know how many guys are in that frat, but it's probably is the largest frat in the country, apparently. Mm-hmm. So in that particular chapter, it's probably quite a few, you know, I mean, a few dozen.
In most fraternities, interfraternity council organizations, especially at larger universities, there's usually at least 100.
Right, so that's probably like 100 dudes, but they only got two of them. That's like 2% of them mm-hmm. because they were stupid enough to get caught on camera. But, I mean, that doesn't change the fact that, you know, this particular chant that they were singing, it doesn't sound like it was anything that was just made up on the spot. I mean, this is something that was like passed down because mm-hmm. the university is something that was formed out of the, you know, civil rights era. And it is probably
the fraternity, not the university.
The fraternity, right? The it was like a, you know, more of a traditional chant, I'm sure. And I've read reports that, you know, other chapters have used that same chant. So it's mm-hmm. not like there's, it may not be something that's officially taught and to all of them, mm-hmm. all the fraternity brothers or the pledges when they pledge, but somehow that chant has able to, you know, move through through the system that people are aware of it and people, and it was a shame, feel comfortable mm-hmm. Comfortable chanting that.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree. Sorry.
You just took a big breather.
Sorry.
Yeah. And the one thing, you know, and I, as I was saying about what can we do to stop something like this? Because it's, I feel as though, even though I was happy with the action, I don't think that by the president, to me, it's more of a reactive, you know, more of a reaction to the situation mm-hmm. instead of being proactive. Mm-hmm. And I think there's situations where you have to educate students because a lot of them, you know, going away to college is their first time being away from their family. A lot of them is the first time being outside the comfort of their community and mm-hmm. their family and people who look like them. So they reach a place in university where you have international students. You have students from all other kinds of ethnic backgrounds, students from different socioeconomic backgrounds as well. I mean, you have poor kids, rich kids, middle class kids, all kinds, mm-hmm. and kids with different life experiences. And a lot of them don't know to handle that. They don't know how to deal in a situation where they're, you know, surrounded by people that might be a more accurate reflection of the real world than the communities that they came from before they came to campus. So, I mean, one thing I know that there are some schools, and many of them do more of, like, you know, seminar training during orientation to teach mm-hmm. kids about, you know, maybe stuff like harassment, bullying, you know, sexual violence seminars, prevention. They might talk about LGBT issues, also maybe race issues. But from what my limited knowledge, it seems like, you know, most of those are just kind of short seminar classes where it's either doing an orientation or something that's not really intensive. It's just something mm-hmm. that's like a check mark just to say, okay, every freshman has gone through this training. And I honestly think it should be more of a real class, mm-hmm. a real credit-bearing class where it's like a 3-credit class for one semester or maybe 6 credits for the entire freshman year mm-hmm. where they really go in depth on all of these issues and so they can help these students learn how to act, how to behave, how to be more empathetic to those that are not like them, because it doesn't seem like people take those seriously. Because, I mean, I know I wouldn't have, I mean, you know, I'm not a racist or a bigot, that I don't think I am, but even if I were to take one of those classes, I would have, you know, those seminars, I would just brush it off, you know, gotten my like, quick little check mark credit and not thought about it. But if it was something that was more of a real full course that I would have to take, I think it would have more of an impact. And I think more schools should consider doing that for their freshmen, like a real class rather than just a checkmark seminar mm-hmm. for the 3-day orientation in the summer.
Yeah, I don't know at what length universities go through to address those topics. Certainly during orientation, those topics might come up. But I think they come up in terms of discussing the services that the school offers to assist students if they run into problems, you know. So I don't know as far as, you know, if there are any schools out there that offer classes to freshmen or otherwise to help them kind of understand all of the nuances of, you know, living with and learning with, alongside, I should say, learning alongside other students who, you know, are different from them. Because like you said, you know, this is a new environment for them. They're coming into a situation where, you know, they're going to face a lot of different challenges and issues, and they're going to be around people that, you know, they've never been around before. So yeah, I think it's a good idea. I do know that some universities offer like a freshman seminar course. It's like usually kind of like a UC course, a university course. And I know, in just looking at a lot of the positions I've looked into applying for, usually I'm looking at academic advising type jobs, and those jobs usually will have the advisor teach that course. But it's kind of like an intro to the college.
Right.
So
right,
it's like, right. I don't know, you know, how in depth they get in, but I think it's more of like, you know, services. I think it's more like, you know, okay, you have a roommate issue or something like that, or, you know, you have right. some kind of like, oh, you know, yeah, like maybe they talk about sexual assault, like if you're ever in a situation like that, or.
But it seems very, know. Like, just very surface. You know,
yeah.
Like,
and that's I'm
what
sure.
I'm, that's what I'm getting surface. At. I think it should be more in depth, mm-hmm. more than in talk about, you know, the history of those issues and how, you know, how people are affected by it and the implications and the ramifications mm-hmm. of people's behavior mm-hmm. in relation to those types of things, rather than just saying, hey, not raping people is, you know, you shouldn't rape people. If you're, and conversely, if you're a victim of sexual assault, you can go to our counselors and that's it. You know, it should be something a little bit more in depth about the issues. And for people who might think that's too much for, like, you know, an 18-year-old kid going to college, it's like, well, it's time to man up. You're an adult now. I mean, that's, you know, it's time they learn that kind of stuff because, you know, quite honestly, you know, these, you know, someone has a young racist is most likely going to grow up into be an old racist. And when it's, and it's people like the kids at SAE, it's like, you know, apparently that's a pretty high profile fraternity with a lot of powerful people who have gone through there and mm-hmm. have become governors and presidents and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is how, you know, racism is perpetuated throughout the country and systematically through the systems that we have set up, because you have people who have these racist beliefs that are in power. Mm-hmm. And racism is more than just, you know, a guy just saying, I don't like black people, you know, mm-hmm. I hate the Mexicans or something like that. Like, racism is applying that power that you have to, you know, bring harm against, you know, another race based on, you know, a superiority complex. So if you have these kids who are 18-year-old racists making chants on the bus, in 10, 15 years, those are going to be the hiring managers at businesses. They're going to be the mm-hmm. vice presidents at corporations. They're going to be the, you know, the congressmen and congresswomen that are making this policy decisions that affect everyone in the country. So mm-hmm. it's something that really needs to be nipped in the bud. And I think just a simple university course or something that's like that is insufficient to address it. I mean, obviously you can't really change the heart. It's going to be difficult to change the hearts of people if they already feel this way, but
right.
I think the university should be more proactive and make it a robust, full-fledged, you know, 3-credit or 6-credit course that's required for all students.
Yeah, this actually, you brought up something that I was thinking about. One of my friends on Facebook, shout out to Kelly Siebert, I was looking at her Facebook and she had posted a message about this incident, and she had said, you know, yes, she understands that a lot of people feel like the university should do something, obviously in response to what these kids did, these students. But then, you know, she said, but what about these students and their parents? Like, you know, does this really start at home? You know, is this really the responsibility of the schools to, you know, help these kids understand what they're doing is wrong? Isn't this something that really should begin at home?
Well, obviously it needs yeah. to begin at home, but the problem is, I mean, the university isn't at home. They don't know what kind of kid they're getting until they get to campus.
Of course.
So the safe, prudent approach is, okay, we don't know what kind of kid we have. You know, they don't do like a moral background check on every kid, you know? So it's like, okay, every kid that comes to campus, you're going to take this course because we want you guys to uphold the standards of our community, be a good citizen in this country, and learn how to treat people and how to be, you know, tolerant of other folks. And mm-hmm. and it, at that point, yes, it is the school's responsibility. I mean, there's nothing they can do about the parents. I mean, it's either a failure of the parents in the sense that, you know, they quote unquote taught the kids to be like that, or a failure in the sense that they were, you know, absentee parents and allowed the kid to develop in such a way where they have these harmful thoughts and acts that come from them.
Which is still another failure
right.
of the parent.
Right, yeah, it's not. They're both failures. One is a failure of being an active participant, and the other is being a passive standby, bystander in the situation. So I think that it is the school's responsibility, because there's no way to know what kind of kid you're getting. I mean, yes, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not blaming the schools for it, because, you know, I when it comes down to it, it's the responsibility and of that particular kid. I mean, that's the person who's doing the bad. I just think the schools, because they have all these people on campus, they do have a duty to be proactive and do what they can to make sure stuff like this doesn't happen. And I just think a more robust class is probably the best approach.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I just have to respectfully disagree. I don't know if it really is the responsibility of the university to take that on. I'm not saying that a class that you suggested is a bad idea. I think it's a good idea and it's helpful, but I don't really think it's necessarily the school's responsibility to help students understand something like that.
Why not? I mean, because these schools...
Well, let me finish. I don't think it's their responsibility, because I really do feel like it is something that you do kind of learn growing up. You know, as we all know, like, you know, a child comes into this world and they don't know anything. Like I always tell you, it's a new human being. Like they know nothing. So, you know, a kid is either taught to love or to hate. And I really think that it's really up to the parents and to their environment for them to learn about that. And if they didn't learn that, you know, coming in, I don't really think that there's much the university can do for an 18-year-old who's had 18 years of learning, you know, okay, this kid has learned that he doesn't, you know, he shouldn't associate with Black people, for instance. Let's say that. And, you know, I don't really think there's much that a university can do to really change that. I mean, I'm not saying that they can't or shouldn't try, but I just don't think it's like, I don't think it should just be a mission of the school to, you know, try to help foster change amongst the students that, you know, may believe something like that. I just don't think that's part of, you know, that shouldn't just be like an initiative to help them learn, like, or untrain their racist behavior. You know what I'm saying?
But like, why not? I mean, the schools always use this in their marketing that they should, you know, they're the ones of quote unquote, you know, makers of men. They make good citizens. You know, you find yourself at this school and they teach you how to go out into the world and contribute to society.
Ways. Sure,
yeah,
in a variety of ways.
So how can this not fall under that mission?
That's again, I don't, like I said, I'm not disagreeing with your idea. I think that, you know, your idea of having a course where students are, maybe it's a scenario type course where they enter in various scenarios, like, okay, you say you're a white student and you have a Black roommate, and, you know, how do you feel about that? Like, I don't mind like a dialogue type of class where students are talking amongst one another and talking about their feelings about, you know, oh, what's it like to, you know, now have like a Black roommate or, you know, an Asian roommate or what have you, or, you know, being in class where you might be, you know, let's flip it on the other end, being in a class where you might be the only person of color in the class, talking about those feelings and thoughts. Like, I don't think that's a bad idea. Like, I think that's good, but that's very different in my mind than the university constructing something where it's teaching these kids to, or these students, sorry, I keep calling them kids, such a habit, where it's kind of instructing them, like, you have a responsibility to what? Not be racist? Like,
I see nothing wrong with that. I mean, you have a responsibility not to rape women, you know? I mean, obviously, that's not something you should have to feel like you have to tell people, but apparently...
Okay, let me give you the scenario. Sorry to cut you off, but let me give you a scenario. It's like... That's like This reminds me of the issues that a lot of elementary school and high school teachers face. Behavioral problems. So as a teacher, obviously they're going to face situations where, you know, a kid, let's take like a third grader, like third grade, you know, they're young, they're eight. This is when they start kind of being a little bit more chatty, I think, being a little bit more defiant against rules. You know, they might be, you know, whispering and stuff in class while the teacher's talking, stuff like that. And that behavior might start earlier or younger, but I think third grade is like, you know, I'm thinking 7 or 8 years old. But I think in those situations, you know, a lot of teachers feel like it is not their responsibility to teach their, you know, teach, like full on teach a student to not speak in class. Okay, as a teacher, you'll be like, okay, you're supposed to listen to me. I don't want you talking. But if a kid is just constantly like misbehaving during class, maybe they even get more, maybe it's more than just talking. Maybe they start hitting or doing other things. Like, yeah, let's talk about that. Like hitting or spitting, kicking, like any type of thing like that. I think a lot of teachers feel strongly that it's not their place to discipline kids or to teach them like this is not what you do. You should be learning that at home.
Right, but that's a different situation. You're talking about
I think it is behavioral.
I agree that it's behavioral, but my point is as far as the mission is concerned of the educators, yes, cause teachers in elementary school and high school shouldn't have to do that. It's more of a family situation. The parents should. But once these kids step on campus, in the eyes of the law, they are adults. They are 18 years old, and they are, you know, they're free and clear to do what they want because they are adults. And at that point, it's like you can't go and say to the parents, hey, you know, Jimmy's been making racist chants on the bus at school. You might want to do something about it. At this point, the responsibility falls onto the school because the school has a duty to the other 30,000 students that are on campus to make sure that they do not have to attend school in a hostile environment, that they're keeping their women safe from sexual assault, keeping various ethnic groups safe from racist acts and things like that may occur on campus. So they have to take it upon themselves at that point and say, okay, hey, Joe, you're on campus now. This is what you have to do if you want to remain on this campus. You have to modify your behavior accordingly. Here's a course that's going to teach you guys what you need to do.
We'll just have to agree to disagree on that. I'm not saying that, of course, it's the school's responsibility to keep students safe and to keep, you know, incidents like this from affecting their campus. I'm not saying that the university is exempt from that. Sure, that's like, yeah, that's what you do. It's like at a company. You know, a company has a responsibility to make sure their employees are safe, to make sure that, you know, if any sort of incidents, you know, like a racist or discriminatory incident occurs, that it doesn't affect their staff. And obviously they would take, you know, if something happened that obviously is going to affect the emotional well-being of their staff, they're probably going to take note and probably fire that person, right? Just depending on what it is. And obviously, like, I can't even really think of a situation right now, but, like, I mean, depending on the situation, an employee may get fired, right? So, in this case, a student may get expelled based on the, you know, severity of the situation, right? I just don't think that it's really the university's responsibility to start teaching, you know, like, how a student should and should not behave. That's where I get. And I feel like racism, the thought process, it's deep. And, like, I just don't think that you can just expect to teach somebody who may have learned it at home how to change that. I mean, you can try to open up their mind. You can try to, like, you know, you can try to get it open, but I just don't. Right, well, I don't know. I just don't think it's the responsibility of the student, of the university to teach.
I mean, it's not necessarily going to take with everyone. I just think more. It should be a more robust course rather than just a simple 2-hour seminar to check off the box.
If they even have it, because a lot of students.
I don't know how the curricula should be designed or how it should be for that particular course. I don't know. I'm just saying I think it should be a little bit more than, you know, just a cursory, take this survey, here's a quick paragraph on this, you know, this behavior. don't do it. I mean, that's all.
I agree. No, I agree with that. And I think a lot of universities don't even do that. Because, I mean, do you remember going through something like that in undergrad? Like, we didn't do
Nothing. Yeah, nothing significant.
Yeah, like, and we didn't do anything.
And that's kind of surprising to me because, you know, I kind of look, you know, with my legal background, I kind of look at, you know, we're kind of law school. You're kind of trained in a sense or indoctrinated to kind of look at, you know, what is the liability? Mm-hmm. The liability.
Yeah.
And I think of, like, wow, there's like a lot of liability here from the other 30,000 students mm-hmm. if you have these bad seeds ruining things,
sure.
you know, and that way,
right.
if the school doesn't take the correct steps to prevent such things. So I just think that, you know, from a liability standpoint, you know, I would side on the side of, you know, these 30,000 students rather than these 10 students, you know, as far as like, you know, trying to make sure these 30,000 students are happy and doing well and, you know, aren't being affected negatively by the actions of 10 students. And that's just the way I think. So I just mm-hmm. think that having a more robust class is more effective at reaching that goals. But, I mean, that's just my opinion. I mean, well, one thing, you know, moving on, I think was interesting and because this particular story got a lot of press and then, you know, internet mm-hmm. and the news and thing. It's like in the beginning, I don't know if they're still doing it now, but the news organizations where they would show this video blurred out the faces of the two students,
mm-hmm.
which was very interesting to me that they blurred out the faces because, you know, in these, you know, considering the last couple of years of all the black men and children being shot by police and wannabe police like George Zimmerman. When these people were shot, the news had no problem putting up their pictures all over the news, like putting them up and you know, showing the pictures of these people and then releasing all the background info they can on this person, saying, mm-hmm. "Oh, this person was arrested for, you know, misdemeanor possession of marijuana. You mm-hmm. know, they got into a fight at school." Like, all this information comes out on these kids and these people who've been shot by the police. But these two kids who are on videotape, you know, making a racist chant, they blurred their faces out. And I just found that very, very interesting. I mean, I can understand if a situation, if those kids, if they were minors, but most likely they were at least 18. And like I said before, in the eyes of law, 18, you're an adult. So, I just thought it was interesting that they blurred their faces, like they were trying to protect these kids, you know, like, ooh, you know, we don't want to put these kids out there as being racist, even though they're up there chanting racist things on video camera. Mm-hmm. And that's the funny thing about this whole situation where the fraternity, the national chapter, I guess, made a statement about these actions do not reflect our entire organization. It's just, you know, it's an unfortunate incident, and it's, you know, please don't, you know, it doesn't represent our values and stuff like that. And organizations always say, oh, this doesn't represent us or our values when something bad happens. But when something good happens, like so-and-so was just elected governor of Texas, for example, they'll trumpet it as, this is an example of the values of our organization. See, we've got these great people who are governors and presidents and things like that. And I was like, that's kind of interesting how no one ever wants to be a racist, yet there's racism all around us. Like, no one ever wants to admit being racist, but somehow there's always racism. It's like, how does that work, you know?
Well, going back to the first thing about the blurred faces, I mean, I assume they did that just to make sure that the kids weren't minors. I mean, that was when the video first came out, so I was assuming that maybe they didn't have that information yet, because, I mean, they could have been 17, we don't know. But I totally agree what you're saying, and I get where you're coming from. I personally just didn't care about seeing them or not seeing them, but that's just me. I don't care.
Well, yeah, I didn't care either. I just thought it was just an interesting thing that I noticed about the,
that
situation.
It is interesting. Yeah.
Because I mean, how often do they blur faces? You know, like, they really don't blur faces that much on stuff like, you know, stuff
mm-hmm.
like that happens.
It's true.
But
it
seemed out of place that they blurred mm-hmm. faces for these kids.
Yeah. That definitely is interesting, but I don't know what the reason was for that. As far as your next point of organizations talking about I'm sorry. Refresh me just really quick. You just said
that. They always like, whenever something bad happens,
well, something that, right.
Yeah. It's like, that doesn't represent us or our values. When something good happens, they trumpet that as, like, you know, an indication of how great their organization is. This person was elected,
right.
You know, the chairman of the board of the top 500 company or whatever it may be.
Yeah. I guess I come from a different perspective because I am in an organization. So I know when there are times where someone in my organization or some people didn't do something that was really that great, you do go on the defense because you want people to know that those people don't represent everybody or the background or the basis of the organization. Like, you know, my organization is a multicultural organization, and we represent women from all cultural and ethnic backgrounds, and, you know, that's the basis of our organization. Now, if, you know, we ever had an incident with a member that did something that showed otherwise, I'm not gonna lie, we would totally go to the defense the same way as SAE did and said, like, this member does not reflect the core values of our organization.
Which would be fine in the case of your organization, because, I don't know much about it, you know, its history of it having any controversy and, you know, bad acts by any of your members. But with respect to SAE, they have a long track record of, questionably racist acts. Right. I mean, for example, in 1982, the University of Cincinnati chapter, they were suspended because they organized a party around Martin Luther King's birthday, and they sent out flyers to this birthday party where they encouraged party goers to bring such things as a canceled welfare check, your father, if you know who he is, and a radio bigger than your head. And that was 1982 at the University of Cincinnati campus.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, the Texas A&M University chapter hosted a jungle fever party that had people who went to the party wearing blackface, grass skirts, and they went on slave hunts. In 2000, the SAE chapter at Oglethorpe University threw bottles at black athletes and yelled racial slurs during a cross-country meet. In 2002, a member of the Syracuse University chapter wore blackface, went out at local bars. In 2006, University of Memphis, two SAE students were suspended for harassing another SAE member for dating a black woman and for having the gall, the temerity, to bring her to the chapter house. And it goes on and on. I mean, there's a track record with SAE and having issues of race. So it's like, you know what, if you say to me, oh, this doesn't represent our organization or our values, I'm throwing a flag on the play. You know, I don't believe you. You need more people, because there is a track record of this with SAE. And for them to just say this is an isolated incident, this is only two guys, is ignoring the problem that seems to be pervasive throughout the organization. And if people are able to say, well, that's not us, that's them, and that's, you know, that's only those two guys, that allows them to ignore the problem and allows it to continue. It's really shameful, because it doesn't force them to address it head on and address it directly. It just allows them to just say, well, those are just some bad apples, where there's been bad apples throughout the history of this organization, it seems like.
I mean, I'm not trying to defend their decision to say what they said, but I'll just come from this perspective of, you know, as I used to be on a national board of my organization, and oftentimes there were things that members did that I felt weren't in accordance to, you know, our values, our principles, etc. Or they were also not in tune with the policies and procedures of our organization. So with that said, I often think that when you see these groups that these other organizations that have a long history of issues like SAE does, I think sometimes there can be a huge disconnect between the people who are at the helm versus the students. One thing I will say is that, you know, it's tough running an organization. They obviously are a very large organization. My organization's quite small. But it's tough trying to monitor, you know, all these, I mean, they have like hundreds of chapters, and it's tough trying to monitor each and every person and what they do and what they think and what they believe. I'm not trying to, again, give them any excuses, but it's just tough trying to keep tabs, I should say, on every single member. And they probably have, I'm assuming, over a hundred something thousand members, you know, across the country. And I just know with experience, I guess I'm just speaking from experience. My organization, again, is very small when I was on our national board, and it was tough keeping up with the small amount of members we had and policing a lot of the situations that arose on our chapters. At one point, I was the national director of undergrad, of the undergrad membership, and basically I fought fires all the time. That was like my job. I was like a mediator between the chapters and the national board. And most of my job, I was spent just putting out fires and policing chapter members for doing just any number of things that violated our policies and our procedures. Mm-hmm. So again, at the time, I mean, our organization was very tiny, under 500 members. So I can't even imagine what SAE or any other national organization that has hundreds of thousands of members, what they go through. And I do have friends who are in other Greek organizations. And so, and I know a little bit about, you know, some of the things that they go through and what they see with their memberships. I mean, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. And again, this is just me speaking from experience, and it's something that is ongoing. Like, you are always trying to make sure that everybody is on the same page and that everybody is, you know, on their P's and Q's and not doing things to violate the policies and procedures or do anything that would, frankly, embarrass you as a member. Because, yeah, like, you bring in some people that you think that are gonna adhere to the rules, regulations, and really, you know, be an upstanding member of your organization. And then, you know, they can do a 360 and be a complete a-hole, can be a complete, you know, just, what was the word I was saying? Just be somebody who just completely didn't realize was going to do the things that they're gonna do, and just,
right.
And there are definitely people in my organization, I'm just like, why are you here? Like, you clearly do not belong here. So, I mean, I just think that sometimes at, especially with larger organizations, there may be a disconnect with how the older, you know, members, you know, I'm assuming their national board, their directors are members who probably were members back in the 50s, 60s, or whatever.
Right.
And now they're dealing with these young kids. And, you know, there's generational gaps. There's all kinds of crazy things that go on. Now we're in this tech age where you can video everything and put it out there.
Right.
And so it's a lot to handle. I mean, thank God that they actually do have videos now, because they probably would have never known about this.
Yeah, and I respect. I mean, I understand the complexity of, you know, running a large organization and trying to keep everyone in line. I mean, it's got to be difficult at the national level to know what's going on at the local chapter level. But on the other hand, I mean, I submit to you, or maybe, you know, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, maybe just it's just that young racists turn into old racists. Maybe, like, the old people at the top don't really care as much. Maybe because they did the same thing when they were in school. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. they might put on a good front and say, oh, we abhor this. We don't want this stuff happening in our org. But it could just be a situation where they're thinking, you idiot, why did you get caught doing this? You
know, exactly.
You know, you're not supposed to be singing the chant outside of, you know, the house or something like
exactly.
that.
Right, exactly.
So it could be that situation as well. I mean, it could be any number of things in any event. It's just that.
Or it could be a whole situation of, they're just college kids. They do stupid things. We all do stupid things in college. They'll be fine. They'll grow up and be an upstanding young man, you know.
Right.
You hope. But you don't know.
I mean, that just goes to another topic I'm not going to discuss on this podcast. But it just goes to that, that white privilege, so to speak, of, you know, these guys are allowed to be kids and, oh, they just made a mistake. But on the other hand, you know, black kids who make a mistake get shot by the police and it's their own fault. I mean, it's just funny how these things work, how depending on who the aggrieved party or the party of interest is in a certain situation is in and how they're treated by authority figures, those in power, the media, and you know, the public in general. It's, it's just interesting to see how these things play out. Yeah, so that that's all I really have to say.
Oh, are we going to talk about our house mother?
Are we? I mean, I really...
Oh, I thought we were going to bring that up because I thought that was interesting, too.
I mean, but you have more insights than me. Like, I mean, I wanted to talk about the house
mother. Actually, I don't. But I did a little research on the house mother thing because I was kind of curious, too, because I really didn't know what the house mother... So there was also part of the whole SAE thing is their house mother at that chapter at OU... was also caught on video reciting lyrics to a rap song. To who?
Trinidad James.
To a Trinidad James song, which the N-word gets repeated over and over again, and they got her on video singing along to the song and, you know, reciting countless.
But apparently she was drunk. That's what I read. She was
drunk.
Right. What was a 79-year-old woman getting tipsy with some college kids for in the first place?
What else is she going to do?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just curious. We were curious, like, what does a house mother do? I mean, I knew, like, you know, of house mothers. I knew, like, I knew of their existence. But I never knew really what they were there for. But I did a little digging, just very, very little digging, and just kind of found out. I found something online that basically says a house mother, they take care of the house. They help plan menus. They schedule repairs and maintenance for the house. So basically they're like a mom, like they're there to kind of run the house. It's so odd.
And they live there.
And
too.
They live there.
Like, how's like an 80-year-old woman going to live with a bunch
I don't think they're always that old, but
she only got that old because she's been there for like 20 years.
Yeah.
But she started when she was like in like 60.
Well, I read this interview of this woman who, was a house mother for a sorority, and she had been there for like 15 years actually, and I was like, wow. But she said, you know, all these things that she does, and they asked in the interview, like, how much does she get paid? Get this, like, she gets paid $32,000 for 10 months, and she gets $300 a month for car allowance plus $300 for her insurance, her car insurance. And she
$300 a month for car insurance. And then she driving a Beamer.
And like, then she gets an apartment. So she said, and she says she has no bills whatsoever. I mean, this is a money job, like a house or apartment. You get.
I know.
Like, I might need to be a house mother, but not really.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's just so weird to me to hear about the house mother concept. I mean, I know.
Yeah, it's weird.
Like, I mean, I know. You know, I guess maybe if you watch A Different World, like. The character Letty, she was like a house mother, but that was more of like she was like kind of like an RA in a sense because
she was
a house
mother.
It was the dorm. It wasn't like a sorority house. It was like she was the RA of the dorm.
Right.
So in that sense, like I understood that concept, but I didn't know. And it's my first time hearing of it for like a fraternity, just like an old woman who just lives there at the house.
I mean, I don't know if every single fraternity and sorority. These are. Historically, if you'd like to say, or mainstream organizations, they're either historically white or mainstream, however you want to deem it, but it's usually these organizations that have the homes on campus, and they're, depending on what kind of campus, they're usually pretty stately. I know at our school, they're pretty big houses. They come with staffs, like cleaning staffs, maintenance staffs, they have chefs. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, these men and women, they pay, you know, pretty much the same amount that you would pay, maybe a little bit less, but almost about the same amount that you would pay to live in a dorm these days, because I'm sure costs have gone up. But I remember, like, looking at the cost per year that they have to live, and it was pretty much just slightly less, maybe $1,000 less than what I paid to live in the dorm.
Right.
So they're paying handsomely for living in these houses, and but they got great perks to live in the house. I mean, you got chefs cooking meals. Like, I don't know what kind of meals these are, but that sounds good to me, better than the dorm food we had with chicken and broccoli bacon.
I know.
Burnt hamburgers.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
We need a house mother for this apartment.
Hey.
What?
I cook.
Okay, so you're the house mother of this apartment.
No,
then.
I don't want to do that.
You cook, you clean.
I don't want to be called a house mother.
Oh.
That sounds so old and matronly.
Matronly.
Horrible.
Oh. Well, in any event, I just thought that was interesting, this whole house mother thing.
Yeah, so. It was very interesting, but apparently, I'm sure they get paid handsomely. Yep. Some schools.
Must be nice.
Yeah, must be nice. Well, all right. So I guess that'll conclude our lively discussion of
SAE.
SAE, yes.
Yeah, and the racist chant.
And the racist chant. And
yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So funny. We're the worst at wrapping things.
I know. It's like we don't know how to end it. It's like.
We should just end it.
We just end it, you know, like right now.